This episode is brought to you by Harrah's Resort SoCal. Nestled against a rolling hillside and just down the road from Palomar Mountain, guests at Harrah's Resort SoCal can expect gorgeous views, friendly staff, available night and day to encourage everyone to have a great time. When I was there recently, I had a chance to dine at California's first and the nation's largest Hell's Kitchen. And it's true, the beef Wellington and sticky toffee dessert are great. The restaurant is inspired by the hit TV show and features a menu approved by the Michelin star celebrity chef, Gordon Ramsay himself. Hope to see you all at Harrah's Resort SoCal in 2024.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
My name is Erica Hayasaki, and I am an independent journalist based in Southern California, and I also teach in the literary journalism program at the University of California, Irvine.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over the world.
Erica, you are a book author, a journalist, a professor at UCI teaching literary journalism, and you're an author of a new book called Somewhere Sisters, a story about adoption, identity, and the meaning of family. And I had the privilege of reading it recently, and I was moved to tears many, many times, and I'm so glad and honored that you have agreed to come on to the podcast.
Oh, I'm incredibly honored to be here, and I'm also so happy to hear that you were touched by the book. And, you know, I was also touched by all the stories in the book. And so I hope that was conveyed. And I'm glad that you felt something reading it, because that's oftentimes one of the larger goals of the work that I try to do.
Can we get into sort of the basic story so we can provide some context for the listeners of the podcast?
This is a story that begins with a pair of identical twins who were born in Vietnam. They were separated at birth. One of the twins went to an orphanage in Nha Trang, and the other went to live with her aunt and her aunt's partner. And they grew up with separate lives. Girl who ended up in the orphanage was adopted, along with another child, Olivia, who's not biologically related. Their names now are Isabella and Olivia. They were renamed by their adoptive family, a white American family from the Midwest, ended up living and growing up in this town in the Midwest. Meanwhile, the other twin sister, Ha, grew up in her village with her adoptive moms, and the twins didn't really know much about each other until one day the adoptive mom in the U.S. Took it upon herself to try to reunite these girls. So that's kind of the narrative, but the story goes into much more depth about adoption, transracial and transnational adoption, sort of the history of twin studies, which have kind of a complex and dark history. So it covers a lot of territory, and also I interview a lot of adoptee experts and engage with some critical scholarship around that from history and from many years of adoptee-centered research. So,
you know, when I was introduced to the book through your publisher, I didn't know what to expect. I thought it was just sort of this going to be a riveting story on discovering, you know, these two different twins. But packed within the storytelling is history, sociology, all of these different tangents of the adoption process, the country of Vietnam, white saviorism. There's so many different themes that come up. How did you find this story?
I had twins in 2016. And I've always been a writer, a journalist, kind of following just whatever my interests are, you know, and I had always even before been really interested in nature and nurture science, and got connected with a researcher who studies twins, you know, had many conversations. I actually wrote about her. I wrote about some of the science, and it was through that article that I met lots of different twin pairs and was connected to different twins. But I learned about this particular pair of twins. And I think I was initially very interested because I also grew up, you know, in Illinois, partly. I grew up until middle school, I lived in Illinois. And I knew how tough it was to be Asian American at that moment in this particular part of the country where I lived. It was challenging. I had a lot of bullying that happened. And I just kind of knew or had a feeling that that experience might be similar for the adopted sisters who were raised in Illinois. I wasn't sure, of course, but then I did end up meeting this family and getting to know them over many years, or several years. I guess it's been five or almost six now. And that's how I came across this story. But I guess the storytelling part of it, yeah, so it starts, you know, and in a sense, everybody might think that they've heard the story of twins being reunited. Certainly we hear these stories all the time, and we see them on TV, and they're like popular in movies and whatnot. But and I think people might come to this book sort of thinking, oh, well, maybe I know what this is about. I've seen this before. I've heard this before. But really, it's about so much more. And that is something that came through in the reporting. Of course, there's the science history, but also just the history of adoption and what it means to be adopted from another country, if you're living in the U.S. and growing up in the U.S., or to be adopted transracially. And so I think of like nonfiction storytelling in different dimensions. And I think that there's the dimension of people and characters. And I also think that there's the dimension that's social. And that's like, what are the social implications and social conversations that we can have in a story that's true like this, or that emerge, the themes that emerge. And then there's the human dimension, which are these sort of bigger themes of, you know, these larger questions we have about ourselves and identity and our place in the world. And so I think that this book encompasses a lot because I often think of storytelling on those multiple dimensions.
And it shows really well. I thought just what you just said about going into the story thinking, you know, it's Phil Donahue or Sally Raphael, you know, or Oprah, twins reuniting. But I'll just say it, it's horrific. It's a horrific portrayal of the things that can go wrong in the adoption, the transnational adoption process. A lot of it is very dark, and you really bring those things to light. And things aren't black and white. Things are, yeah. You know, you really show the nuances of Vietnam's participation in this process, and how, you know, in the beginning, not a lot of people are thinking of much. You know, they're just, it's sort of kind of transactional. And but behind it all, eventually you uncover so many different themes. Now, did you set out with themes in mind, or did they just kind of come as you're writing?
Going into any story, you have this idea that you think you're drawn to. And certainly I knew that, you know, I was interested, of course, in Asian American identity. And I was, of course, interested in, you know, these ideas of, you know, what it would mean if you met somebody who has lived, has the same genes as you, and has yet lived an entirely different life. And what does the science sort of tell us about what our genes, how much our genes really matter in shaping who we are? So of course, these are always in the back of my mind, but, you know, I have always been trained, particularly by some of my narrative journalism mentors, that theme, when you're doing nonfiction reporting, emerges and rises from the reporting that you do. And so rather than imposing a theme on a project from the start, you have to kind of step back and you know what you're interested in, and you know why you're drawn to these people and their stories, but you also have to really listen to what those, where those reporting trails take you. And that involves, you know, diving into the archives and the research if you're looking at the social context of an issue. And so when I talk to, like, about different dimensions and stories, you know, it's so important to get the people to tell you their stories, and they share and they feel comfortable sharing what they want to share with you. But then there, everybody's story exists within a social dimension. You know, how did we get here historically? What are the forces that are occurring behind the scenes that we are maybe just within these systems sometimes that, you know, we don't even see when we're growing up, the systems. So it was important to me to look at the systems of adoption and science as well, to think about that. And then the human themes then, of course, come from the feelings and the reporting and the emotions and the experiences that are drawn from all of that. So the oral history, the, you know, archival history, the expert voices, the experiences, what are, you know, what draws it all together? And to me, you know, it felt like there were strong themes of, like, destiny and fate, and we always are forcing ourselves into it's this or this, it's that, you know. There's, like, this very extreme kind of narrative throughout history of adoption being kind of portrayed as a fairy tale, you know. And that doesn't leave room for the experiences that can be hard and painful and traumatic and be wrapped up in these, you know, other decisions that have been made in history. So, you know, like, how do you navigate this one reality and then think about the reality of the people, the adoptees, and what they're telling you about their experiences? Mm-hmm. Same with nature and nurture. It's like, it's genes or its environment, it's this or it's that. And that's led to some really serious implications throughout history. But yet, you know, science also tells us that there's an interplay between these different forces. So it was just important to me to explore some of those themes and try to, you know, tie them together with experiences. Because in my experience, you know, life is really complex. This is all complex stuff, and I didn't want to oversimplify, so I tried not to.
I read the book and the journey of following Keely, the white mother. For me, I try not to be so binary about my feelings when I'm reading, but I can't control it sometimes. But so it's a love and then hate, love, hate. It just goes back and forth for me. I kept thinking about the first conversation you had with Keely when you first started out. I just kept being drawn to that question in my mind. I'm like, what is the first thing that Erica would say to Celie as she's starting the journey and this relationship?
Well, of course, when I talked to her, and actually when I met these young women, they'd all been through this, actually. So what I was doing was reconstructing a lot of it. I did go to Vietnam. I did go with them, and I did interviews, and I did witness some of the scenes in the book. But they were all years out of this. So in narrative journalism, we call that narrative reconstruction, where you kind of rely on interviews and you rely on photographs and memories and conversations and videos, whatever you have, to reconstruct this particular time period.
It really felt like you were with them for like 15 years, and you grew, that's how I felt.
Right.
I didn't think about it. I just didn't think about you were on the project for 5 years, but now it all makes sense. It just, I felt like you went to this woman when the kids were like, you know, like 1 year old. It felt like that. Now, that's very clear. And that tells you how binary and, you know, my mind is. It's just like,
No. I mean, that's good for a writer, because yes, that's the goal. And, you know, there's a whole history of reconstruction in journalism that, you know, Hiroshima is something I read by John Hershey when I was very young. I was like 13, and it deeply impacted me, and it reconstructed the experiences of these people who survived through the atomic bomb in Japan, right? And so that was, it reads like you're there, but it's all, if obviously he was not there, he reconstructed. So that's what influenced me. But yeah, I mean, I met them, the sisters were adults, or almost out of high school when I first met them, and then are now out of college. So they were mostly adults through this whole process. I'm actually, I think, already 18, but still in high school. And then Keely had also been through this process. So they were kind of reliving it. And that was how my approach was like, I knew that the end point was that the twins are reunited. So how did we get here? What's this?
Right.
And that requires many years of interviewing and like going through these details, and also traveling. You know, I went to the orphanage, I went to the village where I grew up. I had a lot of, you know, different ways that I was able to reconstruct these memories through various people involved.
Now, when your reconstructing these details, and I'm thinking of like these memoirs, like the way memoirs are written, there's sort of a carnal touch to the scenes, and there's like very sense driven and like smell, touch, audio, and you can feel being there as you reconstruct this. But there seems to be, like, when I read books, this fine line between surreal reconstruction and details that will take you a little bit too far out. But you did a great job balancing sort of the descriptions. As a journalist or somebody who's writing a novel, a fiction novel, the lines are kind of, to me, they're very tight, because you gotta describe things. So if you're using carnal descriptions, we can feel it, we can feel the moment of being there. But at the same time, you're a journalist. So how is that balance being kind of like worked out in your mind as you're writing this?
I operate by a very strict kind of set of rules around this. I don't embellish. If I don't know that the sky was a certain color in that moment, like, I'm not going to write that it was a certain color.
Yep.
And sometimes that doesn't make the writing as powerful necessarily as fiction or even memoir sometimes. But every detail that I include has a source. And there are moments when, you know, the moon is described in the book, and that's an image that becomes really important to, particularly to one of the twins, Ha, who grew up in Vietnam. And that's all her memory. And she, you know, we spent many hours on the phone talking about her village and her memories of swinging on a swing under the moon, and how the moon was like her friend, and these beautiful moments of, you know, and that just takes a lot of time to gather those details, but they're all sourced in a sense that she recalled them, or if there's other kinds of details in the piece, maybe I witnessed them if I was there, or like there's a scene with the grandmother of the twins go back to visit their grandmother toward the end of the book, and I was there with them for that scene, and I talked to their grandmother through an interpreter. The scene is very vivid. In some cases, scenes are pulled from video footage because there was often video or photos taken. So there's a lot of different ways to report the details, and it might feel like fiction sometimes when you're reading it, and that's the goal, but I would never cross the line to make it fiction, because that's just sort of my line as a journalist, and it's how I've been like trained to not, you know, there's been journalists who throughout history have embellished or, you know, added a few details to make it even more like fiction, but I try to stick to the facts as much as possible. And that takes a lot of time at work, and it's really hard because of that time that you want to go back and ask, you know, maybe ask somebody, you remember you told me about this moment, you know, when this white woman showed up on your porch and was like, I'm going to take you back to America with me. And take me back to that moment. What did you think? What were people wearing? Like, where were you standing? What did you do? You know, and you have to walk them through that again to get all these details.
I feel so fortunate to do the work that I do right now. It's akin to like being in front of like a Martian spacecraft, and nobody knows what's under the hood. Nobody can figure out the propulsion system or anything. And then the Martian shows up and lifts the hood and begins to tell. I'm not comparing you to a Martian, but I'm saying Martian technology, alien technology, and you lift up the hood and you're explaining to me, because I kept thinking about that. I'm like, well, it's sucking me in. These details are sucking me in, but like, how does Erica know these things, but they're bringing me in? But, and I thought like, if you didn't write that way, it would be so dry.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just like years of training and teaching this stuff. I mean, I teach, this is what we teach in the program where I work, which is it's called the Literary Journalism Program at UC Irvine. And students come into that and they, you know, automatically their reading, required readings are Hiroshima or In Cold Blood or, you know, there's a long history of writers who do this kind of work. And then they often try to do that too. And then I realize how hard it can be when they're doing the long form reporting, that you want to report a story, but you also want to make scenes. And how do you make scenes? You have to, you know, ask the questions that are sensory and really take somebody through their cinematic memory again, which is like their episodic memory, which is the memory we have to put ourselves back into scenes of our lives. And that doesn't always mean that everything we remember is accurate. So journalists have to like be cognizant of that too. Like we're relying on memories, but if there's moments to cross-check memories, and there are moments in the book where people had different memories, and I had to either write that through or figure out, you know, what was going on there, you know, and that's kind of like what we do, which is very different, I think, from maybe in the world of a novelist, which I could never do. I have a lot of friends who write novels and I admire them so much, but I don't feel like I have the imagination because I'm so rooted in nonfiction storytelling for my whole life.
You describe a lot about the twins and Olivia. So Isabella and Ha, but what can you say without giving too much away about their true differences and their true similarities, having grown apart, growing up apart from each other? What are some of the things that you can just touch on about how different they were and how similar they were?
Yeah, see, that's one thing. Much like we have these tropes about adoption in our culture, these fairy tale narratives about adoption, there are also fairy tale narratives about twins, and their similarities are often the focus of interest. And so, you know, I do have stories in the book of like amazing similarities between like this pair called the Jim twins, and they ended up marrying, they were separated at birth and ended up both marrying women with the same name and having their dog with the same name and the kids, yeah, and all these things, right? And we're like, wow, that's amazing. But it's these stories where they're not always actually that similar that don't get as much of attention. And yet the truth is, these young women are very much individuals. And to me, just like with my own twins, I know that they are twins. I know they share the same genes. Even with my twins, they've been in the same, you know, household their whole life, but they're very much individuals. And so that's the interesting question there is, what makes them different? Like, how did they become different? You know, mm-hmm. they, you know, if they share the same genes and all of this, the sisters are, obviously different because they were raised in different cultures. They have some similarities with maybe not always having lots of friends around, like being the most social butterfly in the room, or feeling like it takes a while to maybe trust and have friends, which is why I think with the twins, for example, they really, it took them a while to connect with each other, but they now are very connected and closer to each other than maybe anyone, but I would want them to say that. That's what they've said in the past. But, you know, more than anything, I think that they are not the same. And that's what's interesting. And people don't expect that because they kind of think, well, identical twins are the same. But in many ways, I think that they are just their own people. And that's the result of having this environmental impact on the genetics, the yeah. experiences and genes, and the, and also like the random chance that happens in your life. And all of these little moments, even down to when they're babies in the womb, for example, you can have different experiences, even if you're sharing the same womb. And those little differences can cause differences in who you become, in a sense, slight differences or major differences. And it's like the sum of all those things in a life that shapes who we all are. And for the twins, also makes them different, if that makes
sense. Yeah, makes sense.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know, I'm gonna tread in some ignorant waters here, and simply because I don't know if I ask this question, I hope that you can sort of in your professorial role can correct me. And I'm not trying to simplify it. I want to ask a question that's in my head, but I don't know the nuances of the question. So here it goes.
No problem.
So when, after you finished writing the story and got to know everyone and the twins, God, this is, and I'm not looking for a black and white answer, but do you think that from Ha's point of view, she's more happier with the way that she grew up? Or do you think Isabella, happy is a subjective word, but In your mind, is there any value that each one of these twins placed on the way that they were that they grew up? Like, do you think Isabella was like, "Oh, I wish I kind of like grew up like Ha," or did Ha go, "I really love the way I grew up. I'm so thankful." Is there sort of a mental difference between the two sisters?
This is represented in the book because we talked about their upbringing. There's no doubt both of them grew up, both of them were adopted. I should make that clear. So neither of them were raised with their birth mother, although Han knew her birth mother sort of from a distance. She would come and visit because she was raised by her
aunt.
Sisters, right, for her aunt, her aunt's partner. So they both, they never did not feel loved. They both had families that loved them deeply. And I think they both describe their upbringings with a level of hardship in some points, you know, for each of them. In the book, there's the experiences with racial discrimination, which, like I said, I'm familiar with being Asian American, growing up in the Midwest. I connected with Isabella's experiences on that deeply and how lonely that can feel when you're sort of the only one. Every time she described her life, it was like, it actually did feel kind of like a fairy tale because she loved her life so much, and she loved her parents who raised her. She loved her village. She told me this many times that she never knew she was like technically would have been considered poor. Like, she didn't know what that even meant because she always had food. She, you know, they would fish. They would, you know, they were all, and she was so great at describing her life and really conveying her happiness in her life, to the point where, yeah, she knew she had a twin, but she never wanted to come to America when she was a kid. She didn't know what that even meant. You know, she certainly at times thought, who is my sister? But she didn't know anything. There was nothing to compare it to, I guess, to compare like America or Vietnam, her experiences. She had a beautiful life. And I think there were moments of pain in there too. Both of them experienced bullying in their lives for different reasons.
Yeah.
You know, has parents are part of a same-sex relationship. And I think that was a point of bullying at points, and it comes through in the book for her, you know, in confusion, right? And also just the fact that she knew that her birth mother didn't raise her, that was a point of pain, you know. So meanwhile, Isabella had, you know, a lot of privileges and benefits within her family, and had a loving family, and also had these experiences with feeling lonely sometimes that she talks about. And I try to give them both moments within the book. When you hear from them in the book, it's in third person, but it's all from their interviews. And then sometimes it's in first person. So I bring in just straight oral history where they're just speaking. I just want them to be able to speak and not have the filter of like me trying to get all their interview into, you know, I mean, of course there's hundreds of hours of interviews, so you can't just plop that in a book and call it a book, but you could pull out passages where they're talking about their lives themselves. And I definitely tried to do that. So I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. I'm generalizing, but I feel like perhaps has, I don't know, a little bit more, a deeper appreciation for where she came from, perhaps, maybe, because she wasn't plucked out of her kind of environment the way Isabella was. And Isabella being plucked out of her environment, put into another place, and knowing that she's adopted could have kind of given her a different perspective on appreciating kind of her growing up. I don't know. It's just, I'm generalizing.
You mean like culturally?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, and I think that that's not a uncommon story for, right, even for me or for immigrants, who children of immigrants who grew up in America, for example. Like, you might have this kind of loose connection to the country of your birth parents or grandparents, and you feel, but there's also this feeling of like sometimes imposter syndrome, like, yeah, am I enough to represent this part of my culture? You know, am I enough? I was raised here. I don't have. And so I think that's something that is not unique to, although certainly a common thread, I'm sure, with adoptees and with people who are raised in America and whose parents were not born necessarily in the US and maybe you know, it's just that feeling of like, this is who we are, but then we don't always know. Like, I think there's a worry of like, you know, appropriating your own culture, for yeah. example, if you're mixed race or transracially adopted, and you know, all these different things. So it's complicated.
Yeah, very complicated. It was complicated writing it, I can imagine, because you had to kind of cover a lot of different things in a very short short space. You don't have a whole lot of space to, it was a quick read, and there was a lot to cover. So you did I could tell you did a great job just condensing information but allowing it to breathe at the same time. I want to go back to working with Keely, with the mother, because she, I find her to be, again, going back to, I really loved her and I really hated her sometimes. And, how did you come to earn her trust without destroying your bond with her?
Well, that's a good question. I think that, when I first started reporting the story, you know, I was just listening to the stories of everybody, and her version of the story has always been this, I guess, much more, I don't want to say fantasy-like, but this version of the story that didn't have maybe the tougher times conveyed.
Yeah.
The sisters were open with me over the years about all these different experiences and feelings. I don't know if they were always connected and having these discussions at home. So I think toward the end of the process, it became harder, like much harder, as we went through like fact checking. So I go through the fact checking to make sure everybody's comfortable with, well, particularly with the sisters, I wanted them to know, here's what you said, here's how it's being portrayed in the book. Like, they knew what I wrote in their sections. And were, you know, they never objected in these sessions where we would go through and I would like carefully walk them through, because I know that this is hard stuff and I wanted them to be okay. Keely was not okay. And, you know, to this day, I don't know where she's at to this day at this very moment of this week. But that was probably one of the harder parts, because I think, and I did say that in the afterword, I think.
Yeah, the epilogue, you... Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I was very surprised that that was included, but at the same time, so appreciative of that inclusion of how she felt about it, because there's some truth to what she's seeing, but at the same time, sometimes the truth hurts.
Yeah. And I want to hold empathy for everybody. Yeah. In the story, you know, and this is like one interconnected story. All these people are connected, but like, you know, I begin with their birth mother, then the adoptive mothers, has adoptive mothers in Vietnam, and you know, their perspectives on this will feel, no matter what, totally different from Keely's perspective, and each of the sisters is going to have their own. So, you know, I wanted to honor everybody's interpretations of these events, which I know from writing this, just like how we try to kind of oversimplify its nature or its nurture, adoption is good or it's bad. Like, you know, like there's a lot of complicated conversations around all of this. And I wanted to like show how there's all these different sides of the story and they're seeing it differently. And a lot of it's often based on like how you grow up and what you see and what maybe blind spots you might have too, or, you know, you don't know what you don't know sometimes. And then you're caught within these systems. And so that was important to me, to represent the different points of view And I know that it's very hard. And I've talked, you know, to all of them about that. Sometimes it's very hard and painful. And because I've done this for years, it can be painful to read, even if you're writing your own memoir or writing about family, to hold that mirror up is sometimes very hard, you know? And so I think that's the kind of, that's what also makes this work incredibly difficult and different from maybe fiction.
Yeah, for sure. No, why would a family agree to this sort of research on their life and this sort of exposure in their life?
At the end of the day, it is the story of these sisters coming together and finding this bond is beautiful, because they love each other so much now and they have this unique bond. And so I think holding that as like kind of a beacon through going through the process is probably, you know, I guess that's a good question for all of them, like why go through it? I know that I have talked individually with the sisters, for example, and you know, a lot of it was stuff that they hadn't had a chance to express. And in a way, I think we're expressing parts of their lives that they didn't get to talk about.
Yeah.
And this was sometimes, you know, a way to talk to even their family about their lives. So, yeah, but everybody has a different reason. And, you know, I think also they just sort of knew I was doing this for a long time. so they weren't surprised when they got a call from me or like, let's talk for a couple hours on a random day, because it took a long time.
Adoption should never probably be completely outlawed. However, there's so many facets that we don't consider. I think modern Americans, modern global citizens, we don't really consider the nuances that you talk about in the book. Is there a description or a way you can describe your own way that you think about adoptions, right and wrong, or whether we should, how we should continue the process of adoption transnationally or within our own, you know, United States, our own country?
What I've learned from this book, from reporting this book, and really, I am not the expert on adoption. There are, but I do have an extensive bibliography of people who've been, like a reading list of scholars and adoptees who've been doing the work for years and years on these issues. And my conversations and time, you know, getting to know all of their work has led me to understand just how complex this is, how it is a system that has a deep history of flaws, right? And, you know, there's trauma in adoption and there's trauma in reunion, but that's not what we learn necessarily just kind of growing up and listening right to popular narratives. Like there's, and there are many stories of adoption that have happened where, that isn't always considered, you know, it's not necessarily known or considered or part of the like whole decision. Like that kind of history of adoption of the system and also the kind of pain and trauma and all of these elements that come into play, you know, might not be considered during the process of adoption. And maybe that's changing. But, you know, I guess at the end of the day, this has really helped me understand just what all of these conversations and layers are. And for anybody who's considering adoption, I think it's really important to educate yourself, because going into it blindly, you know, can be harmful.
Well, my suggestion to listeners is, even if you're not thinking about adoption, to pick up the book and read it, because I think having more empathy can produce more kindness to the world as we understand the specific differences in be just being born and not being adopted, and just seeing the plight of adopted humans that are, you know, being moved around the world. Just having this experience, like, live inside my head now, makes me just more empathetic towards humanity in general, and realizing that everybody truly comes from different places that we sometimes is out of our control, even though you're born in the same, you know, to the same mother, but we can't control where our lives are going. Perhaps it's sort of uncontrollable, it feels. Now, did you have any stories that you had to leave on the proverbial cutting room floor? Cause you just had to leave out cause it didn't follow within the themes or parameters of what you were trying to convey.
I always have more material than I end up getting into, whether it's a long form magazine piece or a book. I always end up writing way more and going through painful cutting processes. I think a lot of the research for me ended up getting condensed, and that's because, you know, and that's why it is important that there is this reading list and bibliography at the end, because I think there's a very deep well of research that people can follow, for especially around adoption, and experts who've been working on this. So I couldn't get all of that into this book, right? And sometimes having too much of it like pulls away from the human stories too, which, you know, people are drawn in by the human stories and they want to know what happened. And so you have to sort of balance these digressions in narrative nonfiction with like the narrative scenes and emotions and people. So certainly that was something that just the research end of it, a lot of it got condensed and simplified in a sense. And then I'm only covering a certain chapter of their lives.
Right.
And I'm not getting all the family members. And again, there's already a lot of family members in the book represented. But like, there's a lot more that are not, and there's a lot more time, even from the time that they are reunited to now. That's not a period that's like, I kind of give an update at the end, but you just can't get the whole arc of many people's lives plus all the history into one book and have it be very readable. So I always end up cutting a lot because I'm also trying to think of the reader, and like, you're not doing your reader any favors if you're writing and they're getting really bored and getting lost, then the whole message and the whole story gets lost too, and then they'll put it down and they don't keep reading it. So you have to like always be aware of the reader, and it's really hard with this kind of writing because you're dealing with like so many interviews and so many books and so much research that you need to tuck in there.
Yeah, I was really hoping that at one point I get to hear about is it three other kids that Keely had besides Isabella and Olivia?
She has another son and then three other daughters. Yeah.
So yeah, four.
By birth.
I always want, I was hoping in one of the chapters that these four kids and their interaction, their thoughts would pop up about Olivia and Isabella, because, you know, we could kind of see it from the mother's point of view a lot, but I wanted to see on the ground floor what these other white kids that were their siblings, what they thought of these two that were unique, you know, and separate from the family. But again, they sound like they're accepted and loved, but at the same time, there's gotta be some drama between the siblings as they were growing up.
I mean, I think that the siblings, there were moments of them, there were small moments of them sort of being protective of their sisters. I don't know if you remember.
Yeah. Yes.
One bullied and yeah. And there's also the siblings, you know, Isabella and Ha have siblings in Vietnam.
Right.
You know.
Right. You covered a lot of that, and I really appreciated that.
Although I didn't really get to tell their stories either, you know, and I would think that their stories, you know, could be their own. So that's the thing. Again, it's like sort of also how much you can get into and who are we following? And with a narrative like this, like there's already a lot of characters. And so it was sort of making choices on who I could include, because like all of them are important and interesting and deserve voice in the book. I mean, yeah, maybe there's more books that they can write after.
Yeah. How did this book, the writing of this book, change you?
This was a very hard project because of all the things that we've talked about. I think it was challenging. You know, we were also in the pandemic for part of it, like trying to be a mother and writing this book that was very emotional. It opened my eyes to some of the experiences that I kind of shared with maybe Isabella, for example, mm-hmm. and gave me the freedom to start to think about different ways that I could also write about identity, maybe in my own life or identity issues that I've experienced, you know, probably because of all the conversations I had with her and with them. So I think, you know, I'm still, I mean, it's just coming out. So I don't even know how the book will be received or if it will be received. I don't know at this point. I'm glad that you read it and, you know, had things to say about it, but it took a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of emotions from everybody, including myself, but everybody I interviewed. And sometimes I'm just carrying their emotions around in me.
Yeah.
And that's like one of the hard parts. Like I said, I want to hold empathy for everybody in the story and recognize that everybody has a different perspective in the story. And like, they see the same story differently. And sometimes like them talking to me is also a risk, because they, you know, maybe haven't talked about these things with people that they're very close with. And then they have, now their stories are out there, you know, and all of these things are things I talked about with them, but you know, it's a huge responsibility. And it's also, you know, so it weighs on you because you carry the stories of the people that you spend time with, inside of you, like forever, because they're real people, you know?
And that's a lot of weight to carry, you know. I have that, one of my questions that I prepared, I'm not comparing, you know, a homicide detective going to the scene of the crimes, you know, in their lifetime, but that kind of weight is bearing down on a writer like yourself, that you're going into not the crime scene, but sort of like these places of heaviness and burden. It's impossible to be scot-free or not touched by a lot of the pain and the suffering, and then to be really just somebody who's like an observer but a participant in the observation is a big job. It's a heavy job. And do you, yeah. you know, what's your outlet? How do you kind of like blow off the steam? How do you unburden yourself with that?
That's a good question. I mean, therapy. So I've talked about this in therapy because I've held these stories, and you know, I've written stories that are hard through my life. That's like, personally, I've written a lot of stories about real life people going through things that are hard or complex, you know, horrific, all of these things, all of the above. And I think that journalists sometimes take on some of this trauma. Certainly my first yeah. book that I ever wrote around some of this too, trauma and reporting on trauma. Yeah, I have to believe that there's some larger reason that I do this, that there's some reason that these stories, I do believe that these stories are important. I believe that there's power in telling your story, and there's a responsibility for somebody like me to tell somebody's story and to give some, like the sisters, to give them some agency in their storytelling. So that's why I didn't want them to be surprised by what you know, I said it, or they said to me that it ends up in the book, like it's like they know. But at the same time, it's also scary for them. And so I'm just trying to, you know, do all this ethically and
yeah.
with some high purpose, and hopefully people will understand that, like, at the end of the day, that I conveyed a story that was incredibly complex, painful, and beautiful, and all of that. And maybe you came into it thinking you have heard a story about twins being reunited, but maybe you haven't heard all of these other parts of what that means. And that's, I guess, the best I can do. I guess one of my writing mentors told me that all you can do is, like, part the curtain on humanity and let people kind of take that with them.
Well, I can tell you how I related directly with this story, because I'm sort of like, sometimes I don't feel 100% Vietnamese, and sometimes I don't feel American. Sometimes I feel neither. And I can relate to my two identities through Isabel and Ha, right? So part of my brain functions as an old country Vietnamese man. Sometimes it functions as a modern American man who's born and raised in the US. So I could see, so the book is really for me, for, you know, it touched me on a personal level, because now I can sort of like jump from identity to identity and see how the process is sort of unfolding between, you know, I mean, it's almost like these two people, I mean, I'm simplifying again, but these two people are one person, and I'm getting to see both sides of me because of the growth and the development. So I related very closely to the two sides, the sisters and the two stories, because I live in both worlds constantly, and I'm torn. My own identity is torn as a result of my parents having me in the United States. So it relates very well for somebody like me.
I found those connections with everybody too, you know, in different ways, whether it's like being a mom, trying to do the best you can, like, you know, there's a lot of judgment with being a mother, and like on all the mothers in the book, cause there's like lots of mothers, there's several different mothers in the book.
Right.
And like, you know, it's one thing to come in and make a judgment on any of them, but I can absolutely relate to the feeling of just trying to do the best with what you can.
Yeah,
and what you know and what you have, and you know, like, doesn't ever mean you don't love them. It's just like, you know, none of us are perfect, right? And then of course with the sisters, there's so many levels that I identified with around identity and race and immigration parents, and also just this idea of that like a lot of times our families historically come to America for that better life idea, right? Or for these dreams. But like exploring that idea of like, what if that didn't happen? Does that mean that anything would have been not better, you know?
Yeah.
Or maybe, you know, you just don't know. But there's these questions that are always lingering of like what you lose when you, immigrate, right, to a different country, or if you raise your children in America but you were born in Vietnam or whatever that might be, like, you know, there's certain aspects to our own cultural identity, my own too, that I feel I've lost, right, language maybe or different things. And so it's tricky, and And again, it's not black or white. It's just like the reality of what we kind of grapple with. And yeah, they all represent a different part of that in their stories.
Once again, Somewhere Sisters, when will it be available?
October 11th, I believe, is when it will be released. So should be available in stores and everywhere then.
I really encourage all our listeners to pick up a copy of the book and spend some time with it, and get some tissue out, because there's a lot of moving, really moving parts that, you know, I mean, I'm just going to say, when Ha kept trying and kept trying and kept trying, and she finally got the clearance for the visa, I cried. I like sat in my van and I cried about that. I just was so moved because it's like the fulcrum, the tipping point of like your life is about to change so much. And that was one of the big moments for me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think about that section and, you know, I tell it just the way she tells me. Yeah. So honestly, that's how she tells the story. And she's so good at it, you know, just recounting how the whole thing went step by step. And also the part that always gets me is when she leaves her mom's in Vietnam, when she says goodbye.
Heartbreaking, you know, where she can't deal with the crying.
Yeah, that part is really intense. I think every time I even think about it, you know, and there's so many parts. That's why this is hard. This is a hard story to report because there's like all these kind of jumble of emotions that happens with these real life events.
Well, Erica, thank you so much for spending the time today. I am so grateful that you wrote the book and have spent the time to talk about it with me.
Thank you so much for having me and for reading and engaging with this story. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. The Vietnamese is produced by Brittany Tran. Special thanks to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast. You can also find us on YouTube, where you can subscribe, like, and comment. Please rate and give us a review wherever you find our podcasts.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.